Blog Talk Radio.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the tire.
Hello and welcome to Tame the Monkey, the show where we talk all things mindset and provide stories and inspiration to help tame your monkey mind. I'm your host, Kelly Fryer, a mindset coach from the UK, helping people to create the life they desire and the future they deserve. If you'd like to contact the show today and ask myself or my fabulous guest any questions, listeners in North America can call 646-716-7979, and listeners from the rest of the world can use the chat function by visiting the show page. The chat function is now open. My guest today is Vanessa Potter. Vanessa is a writer, producer, and speaker from the UK. Up until 2012, Vanessa had spent 16 years as an award-winning broadcast producer, working within the London advertising industry, until one day fate conspired to turn the lights out on her. It was the experience of suddenly losing, then regaining her sight that led Vanessa to change direction. Adopting the pseudonym of patient H69, she turned scientific sleuth and turned the camera upon herself in order to tell her story via immersive art and storytelling. The success of Vanessa's blog has now led to her first book being published by Bloomsbury, and her autobiography, Patient H69, My Second Sight, will be available in the summer of 2017. And she's currently working on developing an interactive EEG science art project that allows the public to see and understand the effects of mindfulness upon their brains. This immersive experience is part of a larger neuroscience exhibition that aims to allow neuroscience and the complexities of our visual system to be accessible to the general public. Vanessa is also involved in several other scientific research projects and will be a guest speaker at a number of events this year. Vanessa's unfailing curiosity to find answers compelled her to narrate her gripping real-time account of suddenly going blind, in turn offering others personal insights and scientific knowledge of neurological and autoimmune diseases that is both educational and inspiring. So if you do want to call in with any questions for Vanessa, chat is open and listeners in North America can call 646-716-7979. Vanessa, thank you for being with us today and welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Brilliant. So an amazing journey that you've been on, a really inspirational journey. How do you feel when you look back?
Yes, I think a journey is a good description. I suppose looking back, I wonder how I got to where I am now. And I suppose one of the good things about writing the blog and having sort of documented everything is that I've got this story that I can look back on and mm-hmm. kind of review and stand back from and go, oh my goodness, you know, wow, I'm yeah. so glad that I did the things that I did.
Yeah, amazing. And how do you think you were able to get through such a huge change to your life?
That kind of pulls me into the EEG project that I've been doing with mm-hmm. Cambridge University. And one of the kind of critical things was using mind tools. Uh-huh. And in fact, I tell my story through using immersive art and storytelling. And part of that mm-hmm. journey is about the visual redevelopment and the visual rebirth and relearning to see again and all those incredible visual phenomena that I experienced. But alongside that story was the kind of the psychological story, because when your visual system just shuts down, it's obviously an enormous shock to your body. And yeah. one of the things that I did was to kind of think inside myself, if you like. And I tapped a lot of mind tools and sort of meditation, visualization, self-hypnosis, a whole load of things that I'd experimented with and used in my past. And those became kind of my lifeline. And that is the inspiration for the EEG project. Mm-hmm. And it's about showing how mindfulness and how meditation actually alters your brain frequencies. So that was probably one of the most fundamental tools I used in kind of coping.
Yeah, fantastic. And with those sort of mind tools that you were talking about, do you think that they would, you know, are they useful to other people? Would you kind of recommend those to others?
Well, one of the things about the project was, I mean, it's all very well, you know, telling somebody, oh, you look, you're very stressed at the night, see that, try mindfulness. And they kind of go, yeah, right. And then you go, well, I tried it. And they go, yeah, like I care. The best thing you can do is go, why don't you try it yourself? And then when you've tried it yourself, yeah. I'll show you what it looks like. And that is exactly how that project came about. It was very much about, it followed the story of patient H69, so it explained what I did. And actually what I did was something quite specific. I used a visual sanctuary originally. Now, a visual sanctuary is literally what it sounds like. It's a mental visual place inside your head where you could transport yourself to and feel very safe. And by using these tools, these methods, you can physiologically control your body. So in my case, I had tremors and my nervous system was in overdrive and lots of anxiety. And by visiting this mental sanctuary and using breathing techniques, I managed to control that, calmed my body. And so we used this as a story to draw people in to the exhibit. And then when they came in, we put EEG portable headsets on them and we hooked them up and we said, look, listen to what I did. I'm going to show you what my visual sanctuary looks and sounds like by converting my brain frequencies into moving art and music. And they kind of sat there going, wow, that's really cool. And then we said, now, this isn't just meant to be inspiring, this is meant to be about you. So we allowed them, we gave them a 5-minute guided mindfulness session, which they did themselves in the pitch black in a sensory controlled environment. And meanwhile, we were recording their EEG frequencies. And at the end, when we pulled back the curtains, they came out and they sat in front of computers and they basically saw what their brain had just done. So it was they saw their own brain frequencies translated into the same music and art. And it was absolutely profound for them, because one of the important things that we did as well is we took something called a baseline, which is kind of what it sounds like. So we took a little recording very quickly on the EEG machines where they're not trying to meditate. And that's the key thing.
Yeah.
And then we took the sequence of the 5 minutes where they are trying to meditate. And a lot of people came out going, oh, I didn't do it right. Oh, you know, I wasn't, couldn't do it, concentrating. Oh, you know, mindfulness isn't for me. It doesn't work. And then they sat and we would play the sequences back and their jaws would drop because they would see the difference. And they saw the change to their own brains. And that was pretty big for a lot of people. In fact, so much so, one of our biggest problems was getting people to leave.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think I'd have probably been sat in there all day.
Yeah, we were very nice with them. We're like, look, I know this is very profound. There's lots of self-awareness going on. This is wonderful, but can you go? Because we've got people queuing.
Yeah. And what sort of feedback did you get from the people when they saw that change? And obviously, you know, were able to visually see that on a screen in front of them.
Well, one of the great things was just seeing people's faces, to be honest, because we had a documentary crew there and we were filming it. And I suppose the TV producer in me had questions ready for people. And so we put the cameras in, you know, in front of them and go, right, how was it? And they would just go, because they were so dumbstruck. And we had lots of people you could see the activity in their heads as they were processing this major thing they'd just experienced. It was very experiential, was this. But to try and then articulate it, they were without words. So it was really funny trying to then.
Yeah.
But then, of course, what we did is we evaluated the project. So we then got opportunity to sit with people and go through rigorous questions and a feedback process. And that's when, of course, it started to spill out and people were just overwhelmed. I mean, I remember one guy said, this is, you know, amazing. It's given me tangible evidence. You know, I go to the gym. I look after my body. I don't ever think about looking after my brain. Some people were amazed that even just trying to meditate made a difference to their brain frequencies that they could actually see. That was really cool, because imagine if I did it well, you know. It was like, what could I do? Oh my goodness. The opportunity for them was huge. Profound is the word I use a lot, because people were dumbstruck by it.
Yeah, fantastic. fantastic. It sounds absolutely amazing. And I know from the work that I do, and obviously from the work that you do, there is an immense correlation between the impact of our own emotional well-being against our own, our own kind of physical well-being. So do you think that message has, do you think you've been able to get that message across much more clearly to people just by letting them, again, see that on the screen?
Well, it's funny because people say to me, oh, do people want to go out and start, meditating? It's not about that. It's about self-awareness. In that room, it was purely about making your own mind-body connection. All the other stuff happens in the future. For us, it was just be aware. Where are your shoulders? Of what you're hearing, your feet doing. Yeah, because the second that you do that, you go, so our toes are clenched. I hadn't realised. And that's classic mindfulness. It's about being aware. Because then when you're aware, you can calibrate yourself. Because that's the whole point. In our busy modern lives, we spend an awful lot of time in, kind of fight or flight mode, running this place, running to that place and doing this and functioning on a top, efficient level. And actually, sometimes we do need to just calm down a bit. But actually, we don't even realize at what levels we've got to. So this way of being able to calibrate yourself and recognize, just even recognizing where you're at is very important. All the other stuff comes afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. Totally, totally agree. So moving on then, what impact do you think both, I suppose, again, your own journey and, again, if you want to then kind of elaborate on the project, but what impact do you think that's had on how you now live your life today?
Well, the EEG project was kind of a magical experience, if I'm honest. It was something that should never have really happened because it was so incredible. It came about through serendipity. I had put together a neuroscience exhibition, a concept for a neuroscience exhibition. I'd written my blog and I basically got put in touch through talking to lots of people and asking, do you know a neuroscientist? Because I kind of realized I needed a neuroscientist. And eventually I was put in contact with Dr. Tristan Bekenstein at Cambridge University. And, the whole thing was just a series of events. Like, we had a meeting. During that meeting, we got offered a slot at the Cambridge Science Festival. And then Dr. Anne-Marie Golden, who was a psychologist who was involved, she'd just flown back to the UK. And then there's a master's student who's a neuroscientist. She suddenly became available. And then suddenly all of this was made to happen when really the odds were that it wasn't going to be, where a patient basically got to work directly one-on-one with a neuroscientist and put together this incredible project. And so from that, I suppose it proved to me that anything can happen. There are no boundaries. We made a medical, EEG is this scientific medical measuring tool. We made it talk to beautiful visual graphics. Using interactive and responsive coding and programming. And that, even just that process was mind-boggling. So we did things that, really are very hard to do. And we did it in 3 and 4 months time. We did it in the quickest period you could ever imagine. So yes, I learned you can do anything.
And you said you said there it was sort of serendipity, but it sounds like actually from what you're saying there was a huge amount of effort and perseverance that went into that. Would how do you kind of feel about that?
Yeah, and actually a lot of belief, because we applied for funding for this project and didn't get it because actually the funders said it wasn't possible, which was a bit of a red rag to me being a producer. I don't put my name to anything I don't think possible. And and so I went back to this little team of people who were all doing it in their spare time. They all had full-time jobs and they were all fitting it in. And I said, look, guys, there's not a penny now. What do we do? And they went, we're going to do it anyway. And that was just incredible. And they worked so hard. I mean, people worked, all weekends to make that technology come together, to train up all the neuroscientists, to how we put the exhibition together. I mean, it was a massive amount of work, but oh my goodness, it was so worth it. It was packed out. It was booked solid for the entire run and has opened so many doors for me ever since.
Which is amazing. How do you think you were able to, I suppose, kind of convince that team of people that you had around you and working with you that actually this would work, it would be amazing, it would be such this life-changing experience for you? What do you think was intrinsic in you to allow that to happen?
I think that's an interesting, because I asked one of the guys halfway through it. I said, why are you doing this? You haven't why are you listening to me, this crazy person with this crazy idea? And I said, because actually, from a technical creative point of view, it's an exciting project. You know, you're going to be putting your name to something that's groundbreaking, that's doing something other people haven't done. And he said to me, no, it's because I believe in you. And that was like, whoa. That was a real, very humbling moment for me. And, yeah. And I think people like projects that have a heart and soul. And I suppose this project did. It started off being about me, but what was just, I think, so fantastic is that halfway through it became about everybody else. And it became about everybody that walked through the door of that exhibition. And it was this very community collective experience. And I think that's what made it magical. And why we want it to continue and why we're looking into it, you know, travelling and living on and being part of other exhibitions.
Yeah, brilliant. I think, again, you know, whether from your training, but I know certainly from mine, if we, you know, if we find that sense of purpose and we can make it bigger than ourselves, a lot of the time, that is where the magic starts to happen, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, believing, actually, is kind of 90% of it. Because a lot of people will tell you you can't do stuff or that it's not possible. I mean, I got told that constantly. I remember trying to find technicians who would take this project on. And I'm like, well, that's a really big job. You've got to create program. You've got to create a new language to translate EEG into visual art. And there's other people that have been dabbling in this and doing work. But what we were doing was something slightly different. So you kind of start from scratch every time you do it. So we got told lots of times you can't do it. But I suppose I believe in the people I was working with too. There was massive passion for this project. And it was infectious, actually.
And do you think it was that passion that kind of kept you going?
Yeah, and also a little bit, I suppose it was quite good having someone tell me it wasn't possible.
Just so you could prove them wrong.
I suppose, like I said, I don't put my name to things that I don't think could be pulled off. And also I was fairly determined because this was going to be the pilot. It was only done as a pilot, but this was the first entry point to the whole exhibition. So it was important that it worked. And, you know, a lot of us put our name to it. So we were, there was a kind of credibility and integrity attached to it as well. It was run as a pilot to a scientific project. So we took scientific data. So it was very important to the science team that what we did was credible, that it was done, you know, with the ethics board involved, everything was done completely by the book, I think all of those things were contributing factors.
Brilliant. And you've just mentioned there that you kind of see this going bigger. It started off as a pilot and you see it going bigger. Have you got, I don't know, sort of a 5-year, 10-year plan? Are you just kind of looking for the next event? What does that look like?
Well, the immediate thing, as soon as the project finished, I basically said to everyone, look, I really need to just write my book, because one of the things when we evaluated the project were the people were really interested in patients H69. And in fact, I was anonymous. I was at the exhibition, but nobody knew that I was patient H69. And lots of people asked after, you know, this person. And so I kind of realized that I needed to do more than just a blog. I needed to try and turn that into a book. Which I'm in the process of doing. So that happened. And I got a book deal with Bloomsbury in November last year. And then shortly after that, I was invited by TEDx in Belgium, in Ghent, to do a talk. Yeah. So like I say, it's open doors. And so they want me to come and talk all about the project and what happened to me and my story at their conference in June this year. So those immediate things have happened. And also another large touring exhibition is interested in taking on the project. And we've got a whole bunch of conversations happening on the back of it.
Amazing.
Lots of things, ticking along.
And did you ever think that would be possible?
Well, no, because the funny thing is this was a pilot to a much larger exhibition. But this is the problem. Not the problem. It's a lovely problem. It created its own life. You know, it created such a response in people. It, as I say, it created its own beating heart. You know, it was supposed to be part and just one integral part, but actually it was so powerful, it can exist on its own, and we didn't know that. So that was a magical kind of, you know, side effect of doing this. So we had to respond to that.
Brilliant.
And I'm still responding to it.
Be an international superstar.
Whatever that is, yeah. All I am these days is a complete, I'm a science nerd these days. I just love it. I just suck it up. And I love doing all the research, because the book goes into the science of what happened to me. It's not just a narration of my story. It is that. I've done it in quite a kind of first person, quite gripping way. But then it's the, well, what happened? Because that's why I started this journey. It was the why, what, and how. And in fact, that's why I documented everything. People think I'm insane, but I documented everything from the first day I went to the GP, not feeling right, because I just kind of knew something major was going to happen. And I'm so glad I did, because, of course, that's now all my material, everything that I'm now using. And that is how we can backtrack and work out scientifically, have some ideas and some theories as to what my visual system was doing when my sight returned, because my sight returns in stages, in layers. It doesn't just ping back. It took a year to come back, and it came up very slowly. And so I'm, you know, researching and investigating working with the scientists at Cambridge to work out exactly what we think happened at each stage and why I saw the world the way I did.
Yeah. I can imagine that must have been a quite scary thing for you to go through, though.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, I was without any light, so completely blind for several days. It took 3 days for my sight to go completely, and it literally just narrowed smaller and smaller and went dim to lit, like a dimmer switch, and then it's pink, it went. And then when it kind of, my brain rebooted and I started to see again, the first images I saw were unlike anything that I'd seen before. I had no visual recollection of this world. I saw in black and white. I saw in two dimensions, so no three dimensional. Well, everything was completely shapeless and flat. And in fact, I only had something called high spatial frequencies, which means that you just have this kind of thin silvery view of everything. And there's no form, so nothing was recognisable. And then slowly my sight started to come back. And that's a frightening experience, because, you know, how do you explain your sight to someone? I mean, it's almost impossible. And so to kind of go through that process, you're kind of going through it on your own, really. And it's a very slow process. I mean, it took months for colour to even start to come back. And that was quite exciting, because I suppose I've always been a bit of a glass half full rather than half empty person. Mm-hmm. So any change was that positive. And I used to call them, it's to have these days that I used to call grain of sand days. So I knew I had a whole beach to build, and that sight returned very slowly, and it was a grain of sand each day. And if I had a grain of sand, then it was...
Fantastic analogy.
Yeah, kind of, because it was kind of a nod to the big journey I knew I was going to make. But, you know, every grain counted.
Fantastic. So, listeners, if you do want to call in today with any questions, as I said, the number you can call if you're in North America is 646-716-7979. And for anybody else listening to us from anywhere else in the world, you can send us some questions via the chat feature, which is open on the show link. Now, Vanessa, just going back to what you were saying, really, in terms of sort of how your sight was returning, I've seen some of the, I suppose, just amazing posts that you've been sort of, or snippets that you've been putting on Facebook about your journey. And there was one in particular about a balloon, which fascinated me. Can you just describe that a bit more for us?
Yeah, the balloons actually were quite early on. And because the other thing is I had sensory loss, so I couldn't, I could feel my hands and feet, but they didn't feel like hands and feet. And so I couldn't use my hands and feet. So I was wheeled around in a wheelchair. And this is when I was still in hospital, and my friends took me outside, which is a very strange experience. And for some reason, there were some balloons hanging in a tree. And of course, I had no visual landscape, so I had no recollection of my orientation or my environment. I didn't know where I was at all. But then this thing floated in front of me, and I got terribly excited and started trying to grab this floating balloons for the simple reason that I had a sense of a colour. And so we stole these balloons because I got very obsessional about things because what I didn't realise I was doing, but I was relearning to see. And this had provoked it. It had triggered a response in my brain. And so I wanted to hang on to this balloon and look at it and look at it and look at it and try and kickstart whatever it was in my brain that was desperately trying to kickstart. And so we stole these balloons and we carted them back up all the way through the hospital corridor, this big pile of balloons above my head. We got a lot of looks. And they stayed in my hospital room and I looked at them, you know, constantly. And what I was experiencing, I said to the people around me, I am feeling like that's blue. And they kind of go, can you see blue? I'm like, no, we're not at the far. I know I wouldn't use the word seeing for a long time because my experience was like a sensory experience of the world rather than a visual experience. Seeing was far too big a word for what I had in front of me. And it was a bit like looking through an x-ray. You know, I had so little information to go on. But this balloon, I felt it was blue. And of course, I wouldn't let people tell me what colours things were. And when I finally decided it was blue, I went, like, it's blue, tell me if it's blue. And they went, yes, it was. We're all like, hooray! They're like, you can see. I'm like, no, I can't see. And I found out just recently what that was. And it's amazing. But we associate colours with, obviously, a visual recognition of a colour, but also with emotions. And so what I had was the disconnect. I had the emotional response to blue without the mm-hmm. actual visual data, which is mind-blowing. And you can, using your hand, you can split these things up, and that's what my brain was doing. So I had half the message, which was just, it just makes your head fall off when you think about it. But so I'm writing about that at the moment because I had that a lot.
Completely, it's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? As you said, kind of completely mind-blowing, really. I suppose for, you know, we were sort of saying about the colours and the feeling, I think, again, because we do have that kind of emotional attachment and we have certain feelings about something. You know, if you smell a lemon, actually, mm-hmm. that colour yellow is automatically associated with it, isn't it?
Well, you're getting into something which is on the spectrum of synesthesia, which is also something I experience, which is the mixing of the senses. And I had something called acquired synesthesia. And this is where one sense will provoke and trigger another sense. So in my case, I would touch something or I would use language and it would provoke me to see colour. And I mean, synesthesia is kind of this massive spectrum and kind of in your response to colour, everybody sits somewhere on that spectrum. It's just for me, I was probably always quite high up on it, especially given the job I did as a film producer, you know, filmmaker. Uh-huh. So in actual fact, it's kind of probably not surprising that I had a synesthesia response to my sight loss because other senses were provoking it to come back. So that when you... Yeah. So classic synesthesia is you see a letter H and you think and you see red or you taste a lemon or whatever, but your senses mix up. Like those are that's the way it works. Our senses are amazing.
And do you
things.
Think that helped you on your journey?
Without question, I didn't think that at all at the time. And my obsession with looking at things and examining things and constantly switching around and mixing up my visual environment. What I didn't realise I was doing. Was I constantly stimulating new neural connections to be made and to be reconnected because they, you know, my brain had already hardwired in terms of seeing it, knew how to see. Now it had to refire up all those neural connections to remember how to see. And so by constantly stimulating it, I was absolutely encouraging my visual system to come back online.
Yeah. And creating a number of new pathways, I would imagine, as well.
Well, again, probably not so much new pathways as reigniting the old synapses, reigniting those old pathways and just making them connect.
Yeah.
But that's where, you know, when you say words out loud, your brain hears it. So I would say the word blue, blue, blue. A lot of people thought I went crazy. I'm suddenly got a letterbox going, you are red, 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 you're red. I was a crazy woman talking to inanimate objects. A chapter in my book is called Talking to Lampposts because I did. talk to a lot of lampposts. But the thing is, it prompted my vision to come back. It prompted colour.
Yeah.
So, you know, absolutely. Talk to a lot of things.
Fantastic. I think I think all of us can be known for inanimate objects. I know I'm constantly shouting at my laptop, although I don't think it has the same positive effect as it did for you. What part do you think mindset and positive thinking have to play in where you are today?
I think it's interesting because we all call these things different things. For me, I think how I approached my recovery was systematic and responsible for the speed of my recovery. So, in other words, I would think about a positive end result, and I'm pretty sure that that propelled that to happen. It propelled me along that journey quicker. I mean, certainly when I was struggling in the hospital and using all my mind tools, I was piggybacking really great memories and great experiences in my life to kind of connect to those sparks, the way I felt, because the second that I go back down that sort of memory, I start to feel the same way I did then, and that would overpower the awful feelings I was having. So I suppose in a way I use things like that to kind of change my mindset and to become positive. I kind of made myself positive by going to the positive things that have happened in my life and kind of trying to switch my thinking into, you know, right, this has happened, but where are we going now? What am I doing now? I think that's partly why I documented, actually. The documentation was all about the future. So, and I literally, I mean, people thought I was insane. I mean, I had them writing diaries. My family were horrified that I wanted all these details writing down, photographs of my room, photographs of me blind, all these things. But it's only because I knew one day I was going to do something. I didn't know what exactly, but I was going to do something with it. And so, that's kind of a positivity in a perhaps in a slightly odd way, but that was my way of being positive, was to...
No, but clearly in a very massive way that was something influential, because again, I would imagine it could have been extremely easy for you to go into, you know, kind of a negative mindset and negative thought processes and not be able to imagine your sight coming back, or, you know, just kind of wanting to give up.
Oh yeah, and without question, I had negative days. I mean, goodness, you don't go through this kind of trauma without it hitting you. And you know, trauma is a train crash, however you look at it. And I certainly had a train crash. I suppose that for me, it was over quite quickly, and I think that was down to the positive attitude. And even on the days, the thing is, you know, you're allowed to have negative bad days. I think one of the things we're very hard on ourselves. Everything's got to be positive. We've got to be positive thinking all the time. Actually, no, because you've got to have ebbs and flows. And I think on the days where it was really bad, there's a little bit you have to sometimes just allow that, but just not beat yourself up. Just let it wash over you. Because at the end of the day, anxiety, stress, all these horrible emotions that overcome us, they don't happen to us. It's our mind creating it. It's how we're responding. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you can be so overwhelmed, you've just got to let it all just wash over you. And then you just go, okay, now I can cope again, you know. So having bad days, it's part of it. You can't beat yourself up for that.
But it's that level of resilience, I suppose, and, you know, to get you out of those down days, as you said, kind of as quickly as possible, rather than kind of allowing them to continue.
Well, it's having tools. And again, it's back to self-awareness. It's having the awareness, knowing that you've just started on that spiral. And actually, I'm probably better now than ever at intercepting and going, whoa, right, you know, let's just stop this, right? And I mean, someone used a fantastic analogy recently of the kind of negative thought train, but you can get off. You can stop the train. You can derail it. I love all these analogies. I'm very visual like that. And I use that a lot. So you can, you know, the negative thing will start, but then the trick is acknowledging it and then doing something about it.
Yeah, fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. It's just such a fascinating story. Vanessa, how would you describe success?
Oh, that's a tricky one, isn't it? Success is what is getting what you wanted, and that could be anything. I think knowing in your heart of hearts that you've achieved what you wanted to achieve. And I think you have to be careful, you have to balance out that fits in with who you are and your family and all the rest of it. Because success doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, financial success. For me, it's about, actually, for me, it's probably about being recognized as, just as a patient, but a patient that decided to have a voice and ask questions and who told a story. And if people want to listen and hear it, then I think that's absolutely marvelous. If I sell 10 books, I'm happy. No. It's about being heard, I think, actually, having a voice.
Fantastic. And just to pick up on a point you made there in terms of patient, because I think, again, you know, you hear, particularly in the UK, I don't know, in sort of other parts of the world, but, you know, some of the terrible stories, really, that we hear about the NHS and people as patients and how they're treated. And actually sometimes that it is about a number, just because of all the processes and things that need to happen, and the resources, the limited funds, all of those sorts of bits and pieces. So did you feel that, I think, not wanting to necessarily put words in your mouth, but you obviously felt that you were being treated as a person going through that process?
It varied. My treatment in the hospital, I write a lot about this. It's very much the patient experience is my book. It's not all about that, but it's one of the themes that sits there bubbling away underneath. When you are blind and basically paralyzed, you are very vulnerable. And that vulnerability didn't actually sit too well with me. And I didn't like the way that people changed in their behavior towards me. And I write all sorts of little incidents. So an amazing nurses, and on the whole, I mean, I was really looked after. I had fantastic care, and one of the problems, though, I was called the mystery patient. Nobody knew what was wrong with me. I was this incredibly rare neurological illness that nobody could diagnose. It took a long, long time for them to even figure out what they thought I had. But there is sometimes an impatience. You know, I remember one time a doctor came in the room. And I got very excited because on that particular morning, I'd managed to hold a magazine very, very close to my face. And I'd made out the fact that there was a face on the front of it, which was like, wow, okay. It was amazing. And he kind of ignored the comment, which we thought was a bit, my mum was there at the time. And then he says to me, right, I want you to come down and look at this, a Snellen eye chart, which is the classic, you know, optician's eye chart with the letters that get smaller and smaller. And he made me hobble behind him down a corridor to look at this chart, and I write about this in the book. And I got there, you know, completely out of breath with my walking stick, and I couldn't read it. And he tapped his foot, and that was it. I just wow. And I just said, "You will come back, and you will sit and talk to me." And actually, it was one of those moments where we both ended up laughing, because the NHS has a kind of a protocol. It has systems in place, but what it never does is flexes for the individual patient, because it can't. Yeah. It's not designed to do that. And we just kind of needed to break free of those parameters and those rules and those measures that are put in place. I didn't fit any of those boxes. And so he actually very fairly said, okay, let's be a bit more lateral. Let's go and do it your way. And so we did. And I think that's where I kind of appreciate the doctors that I did work with, that they had that flexibility to respond and to be a bit more human. I mean, everybody that came in my room, I had to touch them, because when you lose your sight, you have to connect with people in different ways. And so I've had eminent consultants standing next to my bed as I held their hand. And of course, they're deeply awkward, but it's my only connection because I can't see him.
So, and in some ways, that must have been quite humbling for them as well, I imagine.
I could feel his discomfort, but it was too important. And actually, what I appreciated is that he didn't let go. Yeah. Because in those situations, you know, you're kind of surviving. And I think he responded to that. But the NHS was amazing. It did a grand job for me. I write about it a lot in the book, just the experiences. I got to know people by their shoes, what noise their shoes make on the floor. All nurses squeak.
Because of the rubber soles.
Correct. And what consultants have leather shoes and they go tap, 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 tap. So I knew who'd walked in my door by their shoes.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Truly, truly inspirational, Vanessa. Vanessa, what do you, what would you say would be your one piece of advice for everyone that's listening today?
Oh, don't give advice unless it's asked for. That's the first thing. yeah, I'm careful with advice. I try not to dish it out because I think, you know, I think that's the coach in me likes to let people find out for themselves. Of course, I fail every morning on the schoolroom with my daughter and I'm constantly dishing out advice to her, which she completely doesn't listen to. But I suppose if I was asked, it's allow change, actually. And don't also kind of don't let people tell you you can't do something. I mean, it's all very well getting advice and listening to people's opinions. That's fine. But I think you've got to have that time where you stand back and go, actually, no, I do know. And and I, you know, I'm going to do this. Even if everyone else says it's wrong, I think sometimes you've got to have the confidence in yourself that actually you do know what's best.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that is advice, yeah, but that's kind of where I come from.
No, that's fantastic. And again, really useful. And again, I think, you know, as both of us as coaches, we are, you know, it's, I think, deep belief in us, but also something that comes as part of our training, that we do all each hold the resources available within us to kind of move ourselves forward. And I think that's a really fantastic piece of advice. Thank you very much.
You mentioned again
some of the sort of tools that you use, but what would you, do you have any kind of top tips for creating the right mindset and attitude?
It's funny, actually, the same thing applies here. There's a lot of instruction when it comes to meditation and the different forms of meditation. I mean, a lot of people who came to our exhibition didn't have any particular knowledge of it. And in fact, mindfulness is only one kind of meditation. There's actually lots of different kinds, and they all do slightly different things. But there's kind of sometimes a bit of a dogma that you've got to do, you know, got to follow it and do it right. And actually, I totally don't believe in that. I used a hybrid of mental tools, and I dipped into different things on different days according to how I was feeling. And I think having that, allowing yourself that flexibility to use whatever works for you should be the way forward. And okay, you know, if you want to learn about visualization, you can follow some guided visualizations and kind of customize it and find your own way. And again, if you want to do mindfulness absolutely has its place, and there's some great ways to kind of guide you through that. But then there's other kinds of meditations and even self-hypnosis, which is a slightly different thing again, which, you know, are all very useful and all have their place. And I don't think you have to be signed up to one or the other, in my view. It was, as I say, it was a big melting pot of all sorts of different things that that helped save me.
Brilliant. So I suppose just to quickly follow on from that, Vanessa, other than mindset, what do you think were, I don't know, one or kind of, you know, the biggest factors in restoring your sight that maybe others suffering from similar traumas could use in their recovery?
Well, I think how you feel has an enormous impact on your recovery. And therefore, you are in control of how you feel. And a lot of people don't realize that they have this choice. I think sometimes we feel that everything happens to us, and perhaps even that other people are responsible for our feelings and our welfare. And I'll only feel better if. And actually, yeah, I think one of the most empowering things is pulling that back inside yourself and going, actually, no. Because actually, it's really hard to begin with, because that means you've got to be responsible. And that's kind of quite tough. And it's also there are ingrained beliefs that other people make us feel the way we do. Or, for example, a trauma, it's made me feel like this. You know, this illness has made me feel. It's not, actually. It's your response to the illness. And kind of just getting your head around that can be very helpful, because then you can go, okay, how? And of course, it all starts with your thoughts. How am I thinking about this? What am I saying to myself? Because what you say to yourself, you'll believe. And so it's really interesting, and you do this as a coach, because you hear what people say, and sometimes we don't realize what we're saying. And I think if you make sure that, you know, if you're in a situation where you've got trauma, know that you are in control of how you feel, and that Brilliant. You can start to tell yourself, you know, positive things, or even just the one good thing that happened that day. And it can be a tiny thing. I mean, goodness, for me, the worst, you know, being able to walk across the room with the stick and go back and sit down again was monumental. Now, rather than going, I want to go back running, I want to walk around the park. No, if you do that, you drive yourself insane. You've got to just start with one small step. And
yeah.
And I remember the first day I actually got over the curb of our, not the curb, the rim of the front door to get down a step, because I couldn't go up and down levels. And so that was just like, I remember we cheered. All I'd done is walk over the front door. But I think those things are really important. You cheered and then I went back down. And you've just got to get that time.
Was a really big achievement for you. Yeah.
And let yourself have a reward for one good break.
Brilliant. And again, I suppose just to kind of follow on from that, I think you mentioned earlier about kind of a glass half full person. And I suppose in those sorts of situations, it can just be about being grateful for the fact that you actually have a glass in the first place, regardless of what's in it or not.
Well, and it's all foundation blocks, because if you do walk over out your front door down that one step, well, then the next day you can go over the step and five paces up the driveway.
Yeah.
And then the day after that, you do 10 paces. And that's exciting. And I got very excited about being able to make it to the top of the drive and back. And in fact, I of course, like everybody else in these situations, you often push yourself. So I'd push myself and then I'd do too much and I'd be like shaking with exhaustion. Next day I'll only go to the drive again. But you have to moderate. But knowing that I had no boundaries, the only boundaries were the ones I set. And within, months, I was walking back around the lake, around the park again, with friends. And I had an amazing group of ladies, female friends, who came. And I was like the dog. They came and took me for walks. Me and my stick and my strange talking to trees and lampposts. we were a comical sight at the time. And they did. They came every single day to my house and they took me out for walks. And that's how I got my movement back.
And that level of support must have just been absolutely amazing for you.
Oh yeah, and I never underestimated that. The power of women and of friends and of support, and of course my husband and my kids, and the power of children. I mean, goodness, one of the most restorative, one of the most healing things in the world is your child coming up to you and hugging you. The hugs were the best medicine going, and as a family, we very much, and also when I couldn't see, physical contact was so important. See, all of those things, we perhaps underestimate them, but actually, and of course, there's neural connections. There's the neuroscience attached to it,
of course,
too.
Yeah.
You release all the happy drugs and the happy chemicals in your body, and that makes you feel better.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you ever so much. Vanessa, just before I let you go, can you just let us know how people can get in contact with you and find out more about the amazing work you're doing, your book, your talks, etc.?
Well, my website is patienth69.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm at patienth69. The book will be published by Bloomsbury next summer. And I will be talking at the Ghent TEDx, that's Ghent, G-H-E-N-T, Ghent as in Belgium, TEDx conference on June the 18th this year.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So as Vanessa said, you can find her on Twitter and her website, H69. The book just sounds incredible. It sounds like you've got a busy few months ahead. And I really, just continue to sort of follow your story and see what happens. But thank you so much for appearing on the show today. You have been a truly just a really inspirational woman, inspirational guest, and such an amazing story. So thank you very much for sharing it with me and our listeners today.
No, thanks, Kelly.
Thank you. Take care. Look forward to seeing all the fantastic things that you that are coming for you in the future.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
So it just goes. Bye bye. So it just goes to show that whatever life throws at us, our will and determination to come through it and the power of mindset can move us forwards in the most powerful of ways. Again, I find Vanessa's story just absolutely amazing. And if you do want to find out more, as we said, just visit her website or find her on Twitter. My next guest on my next show is a sound therapist originally from the UK, but who now lives in Ibiza. Her name is Jodie Swingler, and she's been working with sound as a therapeutic tool for 10 years and holds accreditations through the British Academy of Sound Therapy and the College of Sound Healing. She's a multi-talented musician and professional sound therapist, and the world of sound and vibration is her passion. Jodie left England to live on the island of Ibiza in 2010, and 2 years later, she was offering sound and music sessions at a local residential hospital for people living with Alzheimer's and dementia. In 2014, Jodie became president of an association and continues to offer weekly sessions with the residents, is in the process of undertaking research on the benefits and effect of sound and music with Alzheimer's patients. Jodie will be speaking to me about the power of sound on our mental and emotional well-being, as well as sharing some of her incredible story with us. And you can hear this show at 6 p.m. GMT on Monday, the 21st of June. Sorry, 21st of March. I don't know where June came from. Monday, the 21st of March. If any listeners would like to appear on any of my future shows, you can contact me via my website, www.kelly-fryer.com. And I'd like to leave you today with the thought that a growth mindset open to learning and stretching ourselves can be of great benefit to us and help us open our minds to new strengths and new opportunities. I hope you have enjoyed listening today. Thank you very, very much for joining me, and bye for now.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.